Do background checks work to keep guns out of the hands of the mentally ill? Well, that's one of the central questions at the heart of the debate over gun violence in America. And that's what we're going to talk about today on The Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen will be back on Monday. My guest this hour says that a growing number of mentally ill people have been prevented from purchasing firearms through licensed dealers, and that's a good thing. Mark Fullman is a writer and editor. He's senior editor at Mother Jones. He has produced an award-winning in-depth investigation into mass shootings for Mother Jones. Mark Fullman, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be with you.
So since the, about the early 1980s, somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 mass shootings in the United States, most of those committed by people who were mentally ill, and most of those mentally ill people were able to purchase the weapons they used legally. I guess the question most people would ask is, why would we allow this?
Well, John, I mean, the answer to that question is complicated because there are a lot of factors that play into how the system works. But I think, you know, there's a growing scrutiny now on background check laws specifically focused on mental health. You know, we saw just the latest example of this problem last week in Santa Barbara. There's no one element in mass shootings that is going to fix the problem, but there has been a federal system for tracking people with serious mental health problems, people who have been involuntarily committed. The National Instant Criminal Background Check System, run by the Department of Justice. But historically, it's worked poorly because states have not done a good job of reporting records into the federal system. And that has started to improve in the last few years. Some new data analysis shows that more states, significantly more states, are reporting more records into the background check system. And it has, in fact, stopped hundreds of people in the last few years from purchasing firearms who had that kind of background.
Okay, back up just a second. The NICS only reports those who've been involuntarily committed. So for example, if somebody is happens to be seeing a therapist for depression, that wouldn't get them in the system.
That's correct. It's a fairly high bar. So I believe that's the baseline criteria, is that someone has to have been involuntarily committed into a mental health institution for that to be part of the reporting. And I think, you know, policymakers are starting to look at that now, particularly with respect to what happened in Santa Barbara, because clearly you had an individual there who had serious problems with seeing therapists. There had been concerns raised with the sheriff's department. They'd gone and spoken with the individual, but weren't able to determine anything amiss. Certainly not to check into his background further or detain him. And so I think there's now a discussion of, you know, are the regulations effective enough at catching these people? You know, identifying people who are represent this kind of threat is an exceedingly difficult problem.
Well, in this case of Elliot Roger in the Santa Barbara massacre, you had someone who shot his victims or killed them with weapons legally obtained, and California has some of the strongest gun control laws in the country. His family had reported him to the law enforcement officials. Six officers visited his house, as you point out. And they said, well, there's not enough here. He convinced them that there wasn't enough there for them to do an involuntary hold. But this is California we're talking about. They've already got some pretty strong gun control laws. What more could we have done there?
Right. Well, I think some would argue that even the laws in California aren't effective enough on this particular front. And one interesting idea that I've seen discussed in the last few days is there's a policy proposal by some experts, including folks at Johns Hopkins University, where they're looking at the policy idea of having a mechanism with the court system where family members who report serious concerns about an individual can petition the court for a restraining order against gun possession. So that's one interesting idea that's on the table. In other words, in the case of the Santa Barbara killer. You might have had the family raise the issue, which they did with the police department, but in theory you now have a mechanism where they could go to a court, to a judge, and ask for the judge to prohibit that person from having firearms.
I mean, here was a case of a person who had been seeing therapists since, what, the age of 8? Clearly, something was not right there for a long time before this took place. On the other hand, I guess, you know, it is kind of a, I don't want to use the word ticklish, but I can't think of a better one. It's a very delicate situation. We're talking about people's mental health. There are privacy concerns, all sorts of things. It's been suggested by some that if you ban anyone with mental issues from owning a weapon, that people aren't going to seek therapy because they'll be afraid they won't be allowed to own a gun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there are a number of valid concerns around it. And as I said, it's a very difficult issue, multiple factors playing into it, from medical ethics to personal privacy to civil liberties and the right to own a gun. You know, there's no easy fix here. I think, you know, therapists generally have a duty to report to authorities under the law if they feel that someone is in danger of committing an act of violence. But that, too, is, I think, a very difficult thing to parse if you talk to therapists about that. At what point do they know that someone is going to commit a violent act any more than the sheriff's department knows when they show up at Elliot Rogers' apartment and interview him? So it's a very difficult challenge, I think.
800-642-1234 is the number to call. It's a little bit different number than the one you're used to using for the Kathleen Dunn program, so I'll repeat it again. 800-642-1234. What do you think we should do about this? We have had many, many, many mass killings in the United States since the early 1980s. And all over the place, not just one area of the country, but all over the place. A lot of those perpetrated by people who had a history of mental issues. You know, what should we be doing about this? I mean, it seems obvious that we don't want people who have mental issues to own firearms, or at least seems obvious to some, not to everyone necessarily. But what do we do? It is a complex problem. I'd like to hear what you have to say about it. 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org is the email address, and you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. You pointed out, you alluded to this earlier. I'd like to hear more about some of the research. You point out that we are making progress on the issue of mental illness and gun ownership. Background checks are helping to prevent some mentally ill people from purchasing guns. So which states are making progress on this, and what has worked? What kinds of things have worked so far?
Well, in the last several years, there has been a wave of gun laws passed at the state level, both loosening gun restrictions and tightening them, particularly in, this has been going on for several years, but particularly in the year and a half approximately now since the Newtown, the Sandy Hook massacre, there's just been an intense amount of activity in state houses with respect to firearms. And one thing that's been interesting to watch is that with the mental health issue in particular, it's a much more bipartisan issue. You have a number of states that have passed tighter laws around mental health, primarily focused on reporting records more often and in better, more effective fashion to the federal system. And you have a number of states doing this that are traditionally strongholds of gun rights. You know, states like Florida and Texas, Louisiana, have all put in place stricter laws in this regard. So there have been at least 15 states. I think the number's now up to 18 as of last month. We tracked 15 states last year who instituted these regulations. And there's some variation in what they do, but the general thrust of it is, you know, tightening criteria for people who have a known history of serious mental health problems, whether or not they can get firearms, and or doing a more effective job of reporting those records into the federal system.
So this is a bipartisan issue, but what about the NRA? I mean, they're kind of the elephant in the room on all of this. They have steadfastly, at least in the recent past, opposed any tightening of regulations regarding who may or may not purchase and own a firearm. And then secondarily to that, there's the whole issue of we've been talking about legally purchased firearms. There are a lot of places to purchase firearms that are not part of the system. So let's talk about the NRA first.
Sure. Well, you know, I think the NRA has had some murmurings about doing better on mental health, but their overarching position has always been that, you know, the laws, we already have enough laws. There are too many laws. We need to get the existing laws to work, and that any form of additional regulation essentially is an overreach and a threat to Americans' constitutional rights with firearms. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a, you know, a scorched earth approach to regulation. You know, I think that, you know, when pressed, they would acknowledge, if reluctantly, that, you know, yeah, of course, we don't want dangerous, mentally deranged people to have guns, but they disagree adamantly about doing anything with regulation, essentially to tighten laws around firearms.
So absent regulation, how would we keep deranged people from acquiring firearms?
I'm not sure that there is a way. The real challenge, of course, is identifying which individuals are a real threat. It's very difficult, as we've been talking about. So to craft policy that is effective and not overreaching in that way, I think is an enormous challenge. You know, you have to keep in mind that the vast majority of people who have mental health problems are not violent. That's very important. You know, you can't stigmatize mental health as a violent condition. Many, many Americans have mental health issues. But for this small percentage of people who turn violent in this way, you know, the question remains, how do we address that and potentially stop it?
Well, and it remains to be seen how we define mental health issue. I mean, you know, there are people walking around who have chronic forms of depression, such as dysthymia, but who aren't dangerous to themselves or anybody else on a, you know, day-to-day basis. So how do we, I guess, the definition of that we're going to use for what level or type of mental illness would disqualify someone from firearms ownership, I mean, something like that could take a long time to parse out, couldn't it?
Sure, but look, I mean, we're also ignoring the other elephant in the room here, which is that, you know, you can't discount the fact that there are approximately 300 million firearms in our country, and they're remarkably easy to get. So, you know, that is obviously a key element in this discussion. You know, if someone who is suffering from a serious condition like, you know, the kid was in Santa Barbara, you know, he is able to go out and buy powerful semi-automatic handguns and as much ammunition as he wants. And that's possible virtually anywhere in the United States, including in a state like California that has some of the most restrictive laws. I think the combination of the just vast number of firearms available and the ease with which people can get them is something that you can't deny in this discussion.
Mm-hmm. Here's a comment from Brad on Facebook who writes, if we ban people with mental illness from having the right to buy a gun, then no man in Wisconsin will set foot in a psychologist or psychiatrist's office, nor will they divulge their feeling depressed or stressed to their family doctor. They don't want a mental illness diagnosis on their record. So what we'll have are thousands of men running around depressed and agitated or worse and not being treated. Perhaps that is why a major organization representing mental health professionals is against such a ban.
Well, I think conceptually it's a valid concern to be considered as part of the policymaking. On the other hand, I think that, you know, you're not going to have legions of people necessarily determining their treatment and health concerns based on whether or not they can buy a gun. That seems a little far-fetched to me. There may be some people who make that determination in theory, but again, it goes back to how do you define what would disqualify people from getting guns, and I think we're talking about a fairly high threshold for what that would be.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have some phone calls and more discussion about this topic with our guest, And you can join us. Still a line available for you at 800-642-1234. If you prefer, use our email address, talk@WPR.org, or post a comment or question on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page, and we'll read it on the air. That's how it works. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about gun violence in this hour of the program as well, but from a little bit different perspective than what you'll hear later on Central Time. One of the questions at the heart of the gun debate is whether or not background checks work to keep guns out of the hands of mentally unstable individuals. My guest is Mark Fullman, a senior editor at Mother Jones, and he says research that has been done recently shows that, yes, you can make progress on keeping guns out of the hands of the dangerously mentally ill. And we've been having a conversation this hour about, well, how do you determine who's mentally ill and who isn't, or what type of mental illness would preclude gun ownership? And there are a lot of really sticky issues here. As we expected, the phone banks are full. Let's take some calls. And we'll start in Butler, where Michael is on the phone. Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Important topic. Thank you. What we're dealing with, as we have seen, gun laws are simply not effective. The only people who abide by gun laws are the law-abiding citizens. If you break the law, you become a criminal. What we need is criminal control, violence control. It's the human behavior, the human condition that we need to be dealing with. And this brings in a whole host of social and medical and other issues. So I just wanted to clarify that direction of an attempt to manage or control. It's not through gun laws.
Michael, thanks. Thanks for the call. Mark Fullman?
Well, you know, I think that it's the caller's right to say that it's a complex set of factors that cause this problem and make it difficult to solve. But in asserting the need for criminal / violence control, you know, I think you can't overlook the tools that are being used to commit that violence. I mean, there, as we were saying a little earlier, there are just an enormous number of guns in the country, and they're very easy to get. To say that only law-abiding citizens will follow the laws is a kind of circular reasoning that you know, I don't think makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, we have laws because we want to prevent things from happening, and that's why those laws are in place, to hold people accountable when they commit crimes. It's, you know, like saying we shouldn't have laws against murder because only bad people will commit murders, and they're not going to pay attention to the laws anyway. I'm not sure how that computes, really.
Well, the idea is, I think, that that the law is there to act as a deterrent, and some people will ignore that no matter what. In the case of Elliot Roger, his first three victims, he stabbed to death. So do we need to prevent people who are mentally unstable from owning sharp objects as well?
Right. So that's an argument you've heard a lot in the wake of Santa Barbara. You know, look, at the end of the day, you can kill a lot more people a lot more quickly with a semi-automatic Glock or Sig Sauer in your hand than you can with a knife. So we've seen this problem recur over and over again around the country, people killing and injuring large numbers of people with these weapons. You can't do that with a knife. He was luring people into his apartment and stabbing them one at a time. So that's equally horrific and, is a problem, but it's a different problem.
Mm-hmm. Michael, thanks for the call. Let's go to Janesville next and hear from Zach. Zach, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to talk a little bit about the problem that I think is more prevalent than the gun laws. It would be the problem we have with mental health and detecting it early on. And just the lack of overall health care there is for mental health. I mean, there's probably more people in this state that go on with mental illness undetected than own guns. I mean, that's the problem. If we were aware of these people with these issues at an early state, you know, there's things that can be done to prevent this. And I kind of just would like to hear what he has to say about that versus so much about the guns.
Zach, thanks. The discussion that we've had in this country about how we treat those who have mental issues, particularly after the Newtown massacre, well, we've had a lot of talk about it. I don't know how much progress we've made, but we certainly there's certainly some room for improvement in the way we handle mental illness in the United States. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. Generally speaking, the mental health system in the country has become much lesser than it once was. I mean, there's a lot of funding has gone away. People end up in prisons instead of in, you know, mental health care when they need it. And certainly, I think that's a major factor underlying this problem.
Well, we can, if you look at the way even those who have insurance, if you look at the way insurance treats mental health, then there have been some changes in laws requiring health insurance policies to provide more mental health coverage. But your health plan, if you have any mental health coverage at all, might say, okay, you can see a therapist six times in 1 year, and that's it. After that, you're on your own. You know, clearly, if we treat people who have mental illness and do something to at least attenuate the effects of those illnesses, we'd have a much better chance of preventing incidents like what happened in Santa Barbara. Although I guess you could argue in that case, here's somebody who'd been in therapy constantly, was seeing two therapists, and it happened anyway. It seems like no matter what you do, there is no perfect plan, and you're always going to have somebody who can perpetrate something like this. It really is kind of a head scratcher, isn't it?
Well, I think that's right. You're never going to be able to stop every single person. And again, I think that does point to the availability of firearms, that question. But you're right that I do agree that with a more robust system for mental health care, it would contribute to solving the problem at least to some degree. I mean, look also at the recent second mass shooting we had at Fort Hood. This is an enormous problem with veterans, too. You have, you know, hundreds of thousands of men returning from war zones who have PTSD and are more arguably more vulnerable, some of them, to you know, going off and doing something violent as a response to their condition once they're back home. And they have weapons, and they know how to use the weapons. So, you know, the treatment of veterans is a huge part of this, too. It's something else that we've covered at Mother Jones recently, you know, looking at the lack of adequate health care and mental health care for that population, which is very large.
800-642-1234. Plenty of room for you to get in on the discussion. Now, what do we do about keeping deadly weapons out of the hands of those who are mentally ill? What do you think we should do? What would be the best way to solve this problem? None of us wants to see another headline like the most recent one about the shooting in Santa Barbara. You know, clearly this is a very emotional issue for a lot of people, and we are having a discussion about it this afternoon. 800-642-1234. We go next to Williams Bay, and Joan is on the line. Joan, go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. I'm so glad that the conversation has been opened. It is something we have to talk about. There has to probably be a committee of experts or ordinary citizens to continue this conversation. Therapy should not be stigmatized because people go to therapy for many other reasons than to control their violence. A mentally fit has to be defined. People who give permits for guns have to be aware, maybe educated. And then you go down to parents, fit to be parents, who raise the mentally misfits. Are they fit to be parents? Could they sign a pledge of responsibility of some kind and be aware that this is a very important job? And then you have the accident, you know, the driver's license, and it's a complicated but necessary subject to be discussed. And I really appreciate that WPR started it.
Joan, thanks for your call. Mark Fullman?
Well, I think that, you know, Joan's expressing the complexity of this problem and the depth of it. It's a very difficult issue to solve with so many factors playing in. And I would agree that it's good that there's more of a conversation happening about it now in politics and in policy circles. It also underscores one of the problems with the politics of this issue, which is that they are as polarizing and entrenched as any issue in this country, and it's often a real challenge just to have a reasonable discussion about it. Whether you know you're talking about somebody who's adamantly pro-gun control or someone who's adamantly about having no laws regulating guns at all. So you know, finding middle ground and thoughtful, reasonable debate that rises to the enormous challenge of this issue is still very difficult.
Some of the opposition to background checks is that, well, background checks don't really prevent people from owning firearms, and we shouldn't ask, we shouldn't try to get more of them. I guess it seems a little counterintuitive that they wouldn't help. Why wouldn't we want to do background checks? But there is some debate about that. What you've seen in the research is that at least in terms of preventing some mentally ill people from getting firearms, background checks do work. What about background checks for other purposes? Do we need to be more strict about what in your background might disqualify you from owning a firearm? Should mental health be only one of the issues?
Well, I think it's hard to see an argument for why having more rigorous background checks would be a problem. It's, you know, the main focus is not just on mental health, but also on criminal records. There's more of a movement now and some change happening in very recently with respect to people who are involved in domestic abuse, which is a major problem with gun violence. You know, many women are killed with guns in domestic abuse situations, and we've seen recently several states pass new laws that are essentially working to keep guns out of the hands of people with a history of domestic violence. I don't think anyone would reasonably argue that that's a bad idea, that couldn't be effective. We've even seen the NRA get on board with that to a degree recently in Wisconsin and Minnesota, where they've said, you know, essentially, okay, we'll work with you on some legislation in this direction to try to prevent some of these people from committing violence.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. There's a space available for you to get in on our discussion with Mark Fulman, who is senior editor with Mother Jones. We're talking, well, the genesis of this discussion is whether or not background checks work to keep guns out of the hands of mentally unstable individuals. Mark Fulman says there's research showing that it does, in fact, work. Other people disagree. But we've kind of expanded the discussion a little bit to maybe toward background checking in general as being a deterrent to various types of gun violence. Welcome your views on that at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or you can find the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question there. One of the issues, you pointed this out earlier, Mark, one of the issues with trying to keep the mentally ill from obtaining firearms has been the communication that takes place between the states and the federal government, which maintains the national database. That's also true for other areas of background checks, isn't it? Isn't one of the issues here that the system doesn't have access to all of the records that it needs to be effective?
Yeah, generally that has been the case, and it's for a couple of reasons. One, there's either been no regulation in place at the state level to require such reporting, or there hasn't been funding to set up the infrastructure and make it work well. And that's part of what started to change in the last year or so through new laws being passed in a number of states, and then also an increase in some federal funding to support getting the systems to work more effectively. And I thought I'd just mention a little bit of the data, too, so that your listeners are more aware specifically of what we mean when we say this has started to show some progress. The statistics are from the U.S. Department of Justice, and they reported that in 2013, they stopped almost 3,000 people from purchasing guns through licensed dealers with background checks in the system, and that was a significant increase from the prior year. Roughly over 600 more people were stopped last year than the year before, and that's continued a trend for several years now, since going back to 2009. When you think about the number of firearms in the country, again, this is a grain of sand on a beach. But on the other hand, you know, it only takes one person to go out and do what we've seen in Santa Barbara or at Fort Hood or at the Washington Navy Yard or the Sikh Temple in Wisconsin. So stopping hundreds of people who could potentially do that, I think, you know, points to both progress but also underscores the, you know, the magnitude of the problem too.
We have a comment from Linda on Facebook who writes, "We should hold the sellers of guns responsible. If more gun sellers were fined, charged with second-degree murder, there would be more care in letting people buy a gun." She goes on to say, "If a bartender can be charged with letting a client drive after drinking, gun sellers should also be culpable." That would be a pretty big step, wouldn't it?
Well, sure. I think, you know, that's really pushing the boundaries of what an individual or a business might be responsible for. I mean, there are laws that you know, potentially deter and stop or hold gun sellers criminally liable if they knowingly sell to someone who is forbidden by law to have a gun. But beyond that, it's hard to see how that kind of law would work.
Yeah, because it's a lot more obvious if someone is drunk than if they have criminal intent.
Of course.
Right. I mean, it's pretty easy to see if someone's intoxicated, which is why we have the dram shop laws. That would be a pretty tough sell, I think, for anybody.
Right. We could assume that the Santa Barbara killer went into gun shops in California and seemed like a perfectly reasonable individual with no criminal history. So how is that dealer supposed to know what that person's going to do?
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call. And by the way, there'll be a line opening for you very quickly at 800-642-1234 if you care to join us. Let's talk with Ellen, who's calling us from Milwaukee today. Ellen, go ahead.
Hello. I'm sorry, but I'm probably getting a little off topic here, but there's so many people calling and saying guns aren't the problem, the people are. And I'd like to say that, you know, guns are the problem. There's just too damn many guns. And we have a law in the city of Milwaukee about somebody having an unauthorized gun, whether they're mentally ill or not, could be either. That is a misdemeanor and not a felony. And to me, that seems awfully crazy. I could go out and buy a gun today, and if I was unlawfully able to do that because I have a record of some kind, or possibly somebody gave me a gun, I don't see why that should only be a misdemeanor. And I think that lets a lot more guns out there for all the crazies to get a hold of. Although we're talking about the fact that they bought them legally, I don't know how we're going to solve the mental health problem without a lot of money.
Ellen, thanks so much for your call. Mark Fullman, what about Milwaukee's law? If you get caught with an illegal gun, it's a misdemeanor. Ellen thinks it should be a bigger penalty.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm not a policymaker, and I'm not well versed in the local policies in Milwaukee. But I think she's right to say that, you know, as I was saying earlier, you can't discount the most basic factor here. There are an awful lot of guns in the country, and they're easy to get. I mean, one of the arguments you get from conservatives on this is that, well, you know, criminals are going to get guns anyway, even if you forbid it with more laws. But we have to look at what the data tells us, too. And one of the key findings in my investigation of mass shootings from Mother Jones is that the overwhelming majority of people who commit mass murder with guns obtain firearms legally. They buy them in licensed dealerships or in stores.
800-642-1234. Let's go next to Northern Wisconsin, where Kate is on the line. And Kate, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. And yes, this is a huge topic, and you know, a variety of opinions can be discussed. You know, and I just listened to Ellen make her point about misdemeanor and felonies, and there's all these different topics. Well, you know, I just have one quick question that is a little bit, you know, I don't normally call television shows or radio shows. Anyway, so I'm nanny for my job, and I see these kids who have never been exposed to violence in their life. You know, they come from very, very well-rounded families, you know, maybe it's just statistically saying. And, you know, there's like a two-year-old, and he picks up a stick, and he uses it as a weapon. You know, and he wants to run around, and all of a sudden you see, like, you know, the group of boys at the park, and they're all using their guns, you know, and they're just playing. So it's, yes, it is an issue of the parents, you know, it could be responsible. And, you know, is this making sense? I'm making sense, right? That doesn't say anything.
So it's there's a little bit of a gender issue here, Kate is saying, and we culturally we encourage young people to play pretend to be using weapons.
Well, yeah, I mean it's making the discussion of the issue even broader and more complex when you get into the notion of culture and child development, things like that. I'm not sure that it's that there's any easy way to link those kinds of elements into what you see play out in a mass shooting situation, but it's certainly a worthwhile topic in and of itself. I mean, there's always grand debate about the violence in our culture with Hollywood and with video games and all that too. And that actually points to another thing that I think is worth raising, which is that we don't have a lot of good research on these topics. That, you know, research, at least by our government, has been effectively suppressed for decades, largely in part due to the efforts of the National Rifle Association and its allies in Congress. And so I think there are a lot of things that we still don't know about how gun violence works because there hasn't been the political will nor the funding to have it happen. I've sometimes wondered why it doesn't happen more with private money, with private institutions, or with academic institutions. But there, I think there are still a lot of questions that haven't even been explored, and perhaps this is one of them. You know, how we can really start to measure how our, you know, cultural factors play into this problem.
Well, why do you suppose, if you take a look at the mass killings in the last, say, the 30, 40 years, very few of them by women?
That's right. Certainly gender is a factor. I mean, in the set of mass shootings that we studied, all but one, actually two now, have been women out of approximately 70 mass shootings over the last three decades. So certainly that tells you something very clearly about who does this kind of crime. You know, it's also important to remember that mass shootings are a sliver, a tiny sliver of overall gun violence in our country. And I don't know specifically data-wise whether it's so gender-specific when you get into the broader picture, but I doubt it. I'm sure that there's a lot more women involved in violence in, you know, in terms of the broader picture of gun violence, you know, roughly 30,000 people a year killed. And a big factor of that is suicide, too. So, again, it's a very complex weave.
800-642-1234. We will be taking more of your calls. And let's see. Let's go to Angela in Lac de Flambeau next. Angela, thanks for calling today.
Thank you for taking my call. I think you've covered my point. I was going to make a point about the gender and that most of the mass shootings are caused by males. I wish that there could be more research about hormonal issues having to do with violence. Is there a hormonal imbalance with these young, mentally ill people that decide that the gun is the answer? I would like to see more physiological studies done about what kind of people actually commit those kinds of crimes.
Angela, thanks for the call. Mark Fulman?
You know, I think all of this points back to the issue of how difficult it is to try to prevent these things from happening based on mental health, psychology, politics, what have you. At the end of the day, we have to confront the fact that we have an enormous amount of firearms and they're easy to get, because it's going to be very, very difficult to predict who will actually go out and do this kind of thing. You may be able to do it in some cases, but you're not going to be able to do it in every case. And, you know, I like to emphasize this point. You know, people want easy answers. They want easy explanations for a problem. And so, you know, I've had a lot of people say to me, oh, this is all about psychotropic drugs. People who are on antidepressants, they're the ones that are doing this. Well, there's no data to support that claim. It's an interesting question. What do those kinds of drugs do to people? Was it how they were raised? Was it how they played on a playground? Was it, you know, the way that they were treated in a college sorority house? You know, it's sort of in that sense becomes an infinite problem, and it's never any one factor that is the cause. We're not going to find the single factor to solve it.
Maybe this isn't an appropriate metaphor, but what you're saying is there's no silver bullet for this.
That's right.
Okay, let's take a break. We'll come back and take some more phone calls. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. My guest, Mark Fulman, who is senior editor with Mother Jones. We're talking about research that suggests that background checks are a way to keep mentally ill people from obtaining firearms. At least we're seeing fewer of them be able to do that as we continue to make progress on some of these very complex problems. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in just a moment with more of your calls, emails, and Facebook posts. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn, and this hour we're talking about gun violence, and particularly about guns in the hands of the mentally ill. How do we work to keep those two things from happening? We don't want to have people who are mentally ill shooting other people. We don't want anyone to shoot anyone, but there seems to be some research which suggests that background checks can help reduce the number of mentally ill people who can legally purchase firearms. We've been discussing that with Mark Fulman, who is a senior editor with Mother Jones. And one of the things, I mean, okay, we've talked about the fact that we have a lot of guns in this country. We seem to have a lot more guns than other developed countries. If you compare the United States with countries, say, England, France, Germany, Japan, places like that, we certainly have a lot more guns in the United States than they do. I mean, can you draw a direct line of correlation between the numbers of guns and the amount of gun violence? Some people say, well, that really doesn't pertain. There aren't enough of us owning guns. We need to all have a gun, and then we can all be safe. There are arguments about, okay, so if we want to get rid of guns, how do we do that and still maintain the Second Amendment? It's pretty complex. But Mark Fulman, what do you say? United States, is that it? We just have too many guns, and if we didn't have as many, we wouldn't have this problem?
Well, of course, the answer is not so simple, but I think there is a very basic relationship that we can't deny. We have an inordinate amount of guns compared to every other developed or affluent country in the world, and we have many more mass shootings and more gun deaths and more child gun deaths and more suicides by gun. It's undeniable that there is a basic connection there, but how you get from point A to point B in terms of determining that with data and solving it is a much bigger question. You know, the argument that arming more people would make us safer, personally, I find mostly ridiculous. I mean, you look at the data, there's just no data to support that. I can tell you that specifically with regard to mass shootings, and we studied it closely. There isn't a single mass shooting that was stopped by ordinary civilian who was on the scene who had a gun. It just doesn't happen. Most of these incidents of violence end with the shooter taking their own life or being killed by law enforcement in a situation that often is referred to as suicide by cop, where the killer knows they're not coming out alive. The notion that they'd be stopped by a good Samaritan with a gun it just hasn't proven out. And furthermore, I've talked to a number of law enforcement officials about this over the course of my reporting, and none of them support the idea for what I think are fairly obvious reasons. If you're coming up on an active shooter situation as a law enforcement official and you've got good guys, quote unquote, with guns shooting, how are you going to know who the bad guy is? It just, you know, complicates the problem a great deal from their perspective and endangers more people.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Let's take some more calls. Marty is with us from Lake Nabangaman. Marty, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks. Good afternoon. You know, nothing is going to change in this country. We are going to be having these shows on Wisconsin Public Radio forever until Congress does something. And Congress is not going to do jack anything without us pressuring them to do something meaningful. I'm not the gun control expert. I'm not the mental health expert. But they know what they need to do, and so they need to do something, anything. That they've done nothing since Newtown except cower in their offices in fear of the NRA is so pathetic. I've been calling my congressman and our two senators ever since Newtown. I finally got off my butt and started doing that at least. And I used to ask them when they were going to make some kind of legislative action. But now I'm asking them if enough people have finally died for them to come out of their office and actually say, okay, that's it. I am going to do something.
Marty, thanks so much for the call. Mark Fulman, I think you can resonate to Marty's frustration. That's the way a lot of people feel.
Well, it's been very interesting to watch how, you know, a lot of people have observed that literally nothing has changed at the federal level in terms of legislation since the Sandy Hook massacre. The Obama White House has tried to do a few things through executive branch powers, but, you know, the options there are limited. But as I was saying earlier in the show, there's been the opposite at the state level. I mean, there's been an enormous amount of activity with gun legislation, effectively, you know, shooting in both directions, if you will. So I think it's an indication that the country's perception of this issue and interest in it and conversation about it has changed enormously since that particular tragedy. And there is change afoot, but it's still very much a muddled picture in terms of which way the overarching policy and attitudes of the country are going. Although I think you can also look at the fact that the polling shows that the vast majority of people do support more restrictive laws with respect to firearms. So it's been especially interesting to see that not happen at the federal level.
We're just about out of time. I'd like to try and squeeze in one more call. Craig in Onalaska, let's go to you next. You need to be brief because we're almost out of time.
Okay. What I'd like to see discussed a little bit more is how family members can have an easier time getting help for those people that have mental health problems. It's very difficult at this time.
Okay, Craig, thanks so much for that. And we did touch on that earlier. It might be a good place for us to end. We really have not addressed the whole mental health treatment issue. It's difficult for families to get help. And until we fix that, you know, we'll have more problems, won't we?
I think it's a valid point, absolutely. The mental health care system in the country has a lot of room for improvement, and I do think that would have some bearing on this issue.
So let's take a look at the future as we close the program here. We've got about a minute left. What do you see happening, if anything? We have some research that suggests that better background checking will keep some people from obtaining firearms, but still a lot of work to do. Do you see us making progress in the next year? And if so, where is it going to come from?
Well, right now it's hard to see the national picture changing a whole lot in terms of, you know, what the federal government, Congress might do, but there has been an enormous shift in terms of the grassroots struggle over this issue. You know, effectively there is a large organization now pushing for gun reforms that sees itself as a counterbalance to the NRA, this group that's now called Every Town for Gun Sense, which is funded by Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York. has a lot of money behind it and is growing rapidly. So there's some real interesting battles going on now at the grassroots and state level between those forces, and I've covered that a fair amount on Mother Jones recently as well.
All right. Mark Fullman, thank you so much for joining us this hour. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Mark Fullman, senior editor with Mother Jones. This program was produced by K.P. Whaley with on-air assistance from Jennifer Dargan and Dave Potraz. Next week, Kathleen will be back, and one of the guests she'll have on is Dr. Garen Wintemute. Dr. Wintemute is one of a handful of doctors who are studying gun violence as a national health concern. Since Congress pressured the CDC to stop funding research on gun violence, Dr. Wintemute has donated more than $1 million of his own money to keep his research going. Tune in for that show next week. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.